Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
You're tuning into an episode of the Redefining Society podcast, hosted by Marco Cappelli. Let's face it, the future is now. We live in a hybrid analog digital society, and we must stop ignoring it or pretending that technology is not affecting us. The line between the physical and virtual worlds has become a figment of our imagination. On it, we are continually performing a dangerous balancing act, juggling convenience, privacy, freedom, security, technology, society, culture, and even the future of humanity. There is no better place than here, and no better time than now to muse on our relationship with technology and how to redefine what society means in this new age.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Redefining Society podcast, and I kind of stumbled there because before we start recording, I was very indecisive if doing this as a Redefining Society podcast or an audio signals, because it includes a conversation about generative AI. It includes creative profession and how the future and the present looks like, or it may look like, when we accept or refuse or interact maybe with generative AI, and only time will tell. It seems like it's been around forever, but it's been just over a year that we actually start having access to it, and a lot of things happen. So again, if you're listening on Redefining Society, that's what it is. If you're listening on audio signal, well, that's what it is anyway. So just follow both. Today with me, there is Alex Schwartzman. I hope I pronounce it correctly. I always double check on that because being Italian, I misspell names many times. But I think I got it right this time. So without further ado, Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. And yes, you got it exactly right.
There you go. I'm very proud of myself for that. Very excited about this conversation because, again, it touches on some of my passion, which one is technology, lately generative AI, both from visual then writing, and you know, I play a little bit with that myself, and storytelling, because you are a storyteller, a writer at heart. So I would love for you to introduce yourself to my audience with whatever bio you decide. I know you have some card gaming history as well, so whatever you want.
So my name is Alex Schwartzman. I am a writer, anthologist, translator, game designer. So I've worn many, many creative hats. And I think that if I had to describe myself in one line, it would be a collector of those hats. I always kind of chase the next new interesting creative thing that I want to try because it's just fun.
Yep.
So I've had over 120 short stories published that are science fiction and fantasy stories in a variety of magazines and anthologies. I won an award. I was nominated for several other awards for that writing. I have three fantasy novels out. The latest being Kakistocracy, which is an urban fantasy novel set in New York City, where I live. And I've edited over a dozen anthologies, the most recent of which is the one that we're talking about today. And that's an anthology about the interaction of AI and art. And so, of course, that became a very interesting and exciting subject, certainly a way in which society is getting redefined. over the course of the past year, and that conversation has continued to be on the forefront for many technologists, for many creatives. And so I was really fascinated with the attitudes and the ideas that some of the best science fiction writers across the globe could bring to an anthology like that. So I began scrambling and putting together a team and publisher and all the boring details of producing a book in order to have this happen while the subject was still very, very hot. And so the book was published late last year, I should say. And the good thing about it as well is that the individual stories from it can all be read for free. So if this conversation interests the listeners, they can go to future-sf.com and sample the stories there. And then if they like them, they can go and buy the book and ebook and print formats just about anywhere that you shop for books.
Very cool. And that's something we usually say at the end. There are notes for the podcast so you can get in touch with Alex. But this time we just said at the beginning, that's totally cool. So let me start with this because, my being creative, yeah, a little bit of writing, but mostly, branding, advertising. So interested in art. And when you said a collector of those hats, I think somehow it applies to me as well. Maybe not as many as you. So with that in mind, the first question I want to ask you is your first reaction when you start seeing what AI was capable, the moment I imagine like ChatGPT became available or the Google alternative to that Bard or so on, like your first instinct as a creative person, but also somebody to talk about the future sci-fi and your background. Was it like, or cool?
Well, my first reaction was excitement for sure. I think that the OO parts come later when you start digging into the implications, and we'll discuss that throughout the podcast. Yep. But my first reaction was absolutely, oh my God, I did not expect a robot to be able to do that. And my interaction was first with Midjourney. Midjourney became a sensation probably just a few months before ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. And it was astounding how good it was at generating art, at generating, pretty images. Now, whether they are art is up for debate, but they're very pretty images. And it was able to, programs like that existed before, like WALL-E and some others, but they were just not very good at all. And Midjourney absolutely leapfrogged all of them. And it was producing stunning, stunning results. So, the first thing that you think about as a science fiction reader, writer, adjacent person is that, hey, this entire time, we always envisioned a future where a bunch of robots would do menial tasks and free us up to draw, write, do all the creative things that people kind of in a utopia type society would have all the time in the world to do. And instead, we're all of a sudden we're facing a scenario where it is the robots that are doing creating the book, the books, they're writing, or generating their own texts, they're generating images at an astounding speed and at a quality that at least approximates a real professional artist, something that most of us couldn't do without years of training. Meantime, we're the ones doing the menial works that we imagined the robots would be doing. So the thing, life is completely flipped. It completely flipped the script. Instead of the flying cars, we now have, robots creating all of this artwork and deepfake images and all sorts of stuff that we never thought robots would be doing, or at least most of us haven't, while we're still stuck with being waiters and doing all sorts of menial work. Even though, of course, in real life, there are applications where AI or large language models will be able to help us with those menial tasks down the road. But that's not the first thing you see. You see the big shiny thing.
I love how you just took, in a way, you kind of took the telescope and you flip it and you look at it from the other angle. And then you saw things, instead of closer, you saw it far away. Or inverted in a way. That's kind of like the visual I got. But it can make you think. I mean, I agree with you. And definitely part of the conversation is that art? Like, what qualifies art? And we can definitely go there. What is the, in general, I mean, you interact with other writers. This is an anthology, and the question is about the interaction between AI and art. You feel like it leans more on one side, like, no, this is bad, or it feels, or is more on the other side where more creative are welcoming that? Because I kind of see the two opposite, and few people like me that try to stay in the middle and say, well, look, there is the good and there is the bad.
So among the creative community, it is overwhelmingly seen as a negative. Not perhaps the underlying technology, but how the technology is being applied. So first of all, no matter whether this is a correct stance or an illogical stance, it is absolutely reasonable to expect that people who are in fear of losing their jobs to this new technology to dislike it. I mean, that's how we got the Luddites back in the day, right?
Yes.
Luddites were not, in fact, against technology. They were, in fact, against how the technology was being utilized and used to essentially eliminate their jobs, pay them less money, etc. So we are, in a way, the modern Luddites in that many creatives kind of adopted this very negative outlook on what's coming in the future. The artists were affected first because the artists are, you know, feel like they're losing work, especially commercial illustrators, people who are not necessarily drawing paintings that will go up on the walls of some fine gallery, but, you know, they're doing book covers, they're doing interior artwork and things like that, which already were relatively low paying jobs when it comes to creative output. And so people who couldn't afford or barely could afford to hire them in the first place were among the first to eagerly jump on the train of, well, I can have something almost as good for free if I just, you know, input a bunch of prompts into Midjourney or similar program. So the artists are the ones that got affected first. The other creatives, the writers, they see the writing on the wall, pardon the pun, and they kind of feel, well, ChatGPT, Gemini, all of these large language models, they actually are absolutely terrible at writing. They write about on par with a fifth or sixth grader. Essay, which is why it's such a big problem for teachers as well, because kids are using it to cheat on their school assignments. And it's hard to tell since that's the level of writing that AI is currently capable of. But we're also conscious of the fact that it's only been, as you said in the introduction, it's only been a year. Who is to say that 2, 3, 5 years from now, you're not going to have such a significant advancement in their capabilities that you will be able to have AI spit out a book that is on par with the writing by a competent writer. Right. And then where will we be? Now for the anthology, I did not want every single story to kind of illuminate the doom and gloom of the situation. I wanted a variety of perspectives and opinions, and I wanted the writers to do what we do best, to think deeply about the upcoming technologies and how they will influence the world and come up with scenarios that are not obvious. And so not every story in the book views this forthcoming technology as a negative. There are definitely positive scenarios, there are neutral scenarios, so there's every kind of like approach imaginable. And that's exactly how I want it, because you don't want, like, if you get an album, you don't want every song to kind of strike the exact same note, right? And that's true of anthologies as well. You want a variety of perspectives. You want some stories to be funny, some stories to be dark, some stories to be optimistic, etc.
Yeah, if we go back to the vinyl, I would say you want every album to have a lot of singles in it, right?
Right.
some B-sides, that's good too. I love this perspective. When I saw the AI and the generative AI start playing with it, at the beginning I was like, wow, this is impressive. Like, write a song about, I don't know, a dog flying to the moon. And it rhymed, the chorus, and okay, make a poetry out of that in the style of Shakespeare. Cool. Then you start to ask it to become creative. And that's where I found that at best it was mediocre. And I'm saying at best. And I'm like, this is going to be good for those that don't really know how to write, that don't really know how to illustrate. It's going to probably not take the job of the really good one. But my question is, how do you become a good one if you don't get a chance to practice your skills in a way? So how the apprentice become the master was the big question in my head. So any feeling similar to that on your side?
Well, most things are that are worth doing take a lot of effort and a lot of practice and a lot of sweat equity before you become good at it. And it doesn't matter if you're an artist or an IT professional. It's years of experience that you put into it that make you very good at what you do. Most people who end up, and even before AI was a thing, right? Writers would very often encounter people who would go like, oh, when I retire, I'm going to write a novel. Mm. And in a way, that's a bit insulting, isn't it? It's kind of like me going to that person, oh, yeah, well, when I retire, I'm going to do accounting that you do now. You know, it's not something you retire into. If you want to do it well, it's something that you put a lot of work and a lot of effort into learning how to do and then into doing it. Months and months and months of work to write a quality book. So people who are putting in prompts into Midjourney or giving little prompts like the one you mentioned, like write me a song about dogs on the moon, they're not actually artists any more than somebody ordering a burger from a waiter is a chef. They are using technology for fun, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think it's perfectly fine to use it for non-commercial purposes, and it's a really, really great way to have technology help you be creative by brainstorming. So, for example, absolutely, if I'm writing a scene and I want to write a scene about a bunch of aliens fighting on spaceships, I can ask one of these bots to come up with, you know, with images that might inspire something in my meat brain that's going to actually be creative and write something new about it, right? What I have a problem with is people who are looking to monetize it, and they actually think that being able to deftly input prompts that'll generate a slightly better image makes them artists. Mm-hmm. It is a skill, just like using Photoshop is a skill, but using Photoshop does not make you an artist. You know, doing something creative with Photoshop, an artist can use Photoshop, but not everybody who uses Photoshop is an artist.
Yeah, and I think this is a good bridge to get into maybe what you think about define creativity and art, because it's a huge question. It's, for me, it's like the meaning of life. When I look at it from a philosophical perspective, it is that important. Personally, I think experience, it's what you put into your art. It may be a painting, it may be Ansel Adams photography, it may be, you know, a director that write a movie or a musician. Clearly, computer don't have that right now. I don't know, in the future. So what is the definition on for you about what makes art?
So, I mean, art is something that it's a creative process that an intelligence comes up with. A very common misconception, and it's baked right into the name, is that AI has intelligence.
Mistake. Wrong name. Absolutely.
Absolutely the wrong name. Down the line in the future, the ultimate goal of people who work in this technology is to create an actual thinking machine, something that can make decisions, can not just emulate intelligence, but have intelligence. The things that we're using now, ChatGPT, Midjourney, all of these things, they are what's called large language models, LLMs. Essentially, they're huge databases that crunch together a lot of input, whether that input is images, text, anything on the internet, huge, huge amounts of data. And they digitize that data and they turn it into numbers. And when you ask it a query, whether you ask it to draw a picture, whether you ask it to write a bunch of text, the answer that it generally gives you is to approximate the response that you would get from a human being by, you know, to a similar query. Mm-hmm. So essentially, its goal is to look as much like a real response as possible, without actually trying to be accurate. And that's how you get a weird number of fingers or details bleeding into the image that shouldn't be there, because it doesn't actually think about these things. It's just generating using the data sets. And also, that's how you get the ChatGPT and similar programs blatantly lying to you and giving you incorrect information. But it's doing so with a tremendous amount of confidence, which then makes you think, well, that really sounds accurate. So for this book, when I was writing this book, I asked Bard and ChatGPT to come up with my bio, to ask it to write my bio. And the bio that it wrote, to somebody who doesn't know me, sounds perfectly plausible. Like, if you don't know me, everything that it says, it doesn't say anything outlandish. It doesn't say that I'm a moon alien with three eyes. It doesn't say that, you know, that I'm Lady Gaga. It all sounds like something that could be plausible. Could I have gone to a university that they mentioned? I think they said UPenn. Sure, I could have. I've never been to UPenn, but it's plausible that I could have. Could I have been published in anthologies or won the awards that it mentioned? Sure, I could have. I didn't. But a person reading that, if you were just to take that entry and say this came from Wikipedia and show it to somebody who doesn't know me, then yeah, it would be plausible, but is just not true. Which, bringing it back to your original question, isn't that art? Isn't that writing? It's coming up with a completely fake thing that sounds legitimate. So that's why it's such a complicated question. Because when AI gets to the point where they want it to get, which is to hallucinate information, that actually begins to approach very closely to the point where it's actually creating. You know, when it's just collating information and kind of generating, you know, putting data together, that's not creative. But once it invents new things that are not real, once it's lying to us, then in a way that is writing. I mean, maybe not very good writing, but writing.
But it's still random, right? I mean, I like the brainstorming, because that probability of not knowing exactly why, but it does make it sound like it is. Sometimes it may get the sixth finger, as you said, may put something weird that we just randomly, we would have never thought. And then as an artist, you can say, that's kind of cool. Let me take that and bring it to the next level. But still, the point is, it's so random that I just can't justify the fact that that is art. But again, that is at this moment. I don't know when will be the time that then it has his own experience, AI, and then can write something based on what they experience. A trip to the moon, and, you know, all 9,000, or making a decision in that way. Tell me a little bit more about the anthology, which I love short story. My favorite things to read, so I would definitely dig into that. Any of these that, I don't know, completely blow your mind, or I'm not asking you to name your favorite child, but something that stick more than others that you want to share with the public.
So yeah, like you said, it's very hard to choose your favorites, because I work with these authors and edit these stories and help kind of, you know, bring them into the world. So it's difficult to choose between them. What I will say is that I wanted to make sure that there was a global perspective to this. So many of the anthologies have kind of just the perspective that we expect, which is just a bunch of, you know, American middle class or upper middle class writers that are generally older, that are generally whiter. They're kind of, you know, homogenous in a way. Right. So what I did is I went out of my way and worked with a lot of translators, worked with a lot of authors from across the globe. And so we have stories. We have several stories from China. We have several stories from Ukraine. We have stories from South America and Madagascar and Sri Lanka and Japan. So it's a truly global perspective. And of course, I would also have to be conscious of the fact that we need to sell the book, which means you need to put big names on the cover. And so we do have Hugo and Nebula winning authors in the book, like Ken Liu and Adrian Tchaikovsky, and you know, fascinating TV writers like Jane Espenson. You know, so they bring their perspectives to the book as well. Perhaps And again, it's not so much a matter of my favorite, but the story that I thought would stand the greatest chance of being nominated for awards out of this anthology is actually a story that was originally written something like 20 years ago, and is also the longest piece in the book. The story is called Prompt, and it's by Sergei and Marina Dyachenko, which is a pair of Ukrainian writers who are primarily known for writing fantasy. And they ended up actually moving to the United States. So thankfully, they were safe from the war and working in Hollywood for a number of years. But the story was translated, originally it was written in Russian, and it was translated from Russian, and it's a novella. So it's a pretty long story. And in this novella, the character of, a Prompt is essentially an AI that runs a theater, and it auditions and decides which plays will be produced in this theater, and given all the benefits and all the enhancements that AI is capable of to make them look much, much better than a regular human being, a regular human producer could do on their own, and which ones are not worth the society's attention. So essentially, in this case, the AI is the curator rather than the creative, but the power of the curator as somebody who is a curator of this anthology is very important as well. So that's one fascinating perspective that I really like that we were able to get it translated and share it with Anglophone readers for the first time. Another story that really stood out to me was by one of the Chinese authors in the book, and they wrote a scenario where an AI was used to overlay beautiful images and art over the horrendous real-life images of war for soldiers in combat. And so that way they were able to kind of maintain their sanity and be able to continue to go about their grisly work of warfare. And I thought, the story is called A Beautiful War, and I thought it was just a really interesting perspective, and especially cogent today. So that's so those are a couple of standouts. But again, I mean, it's so difficult to choose because there are great many different ideas and perspectives, and some of them are much closer to today, where we're talking about stories that extrapolate from ChatGPT and things like that, and what will happen in the next 5 years, 10 years. And some of these stories are centuries in the future with truly true artificial intelligences, and kind of demonstrating how those would interact with art.
Wow. And I didn't want you to make choices between the many artists either. I was like, I wanted to know what you said, which like a couple of ideas that the writer came up with. And the ethical consequence of the one where the AI decide who is going to be going on story on stage, it's pretty much what we don't like about AI now, making decision for hiring, for giving a loan to someone, or it's kind of like that the guardrail is use it to get to a conclusion, but don't let them make the conclusion for you. And yeah, he's not the creator, but he's also the one that decide who's going to make it or not. So a lot to unpack there. It could be just one episode of Redefining Society just for that, for sure. I'd like to take the last few minutes that we have here, and this is a large conversation. I'm really enjoying it. I may ask you to come back eventually and touch on other aspects of the things that you do, but the fact that you said at the beginning that the artist was one of the first to be touched in terms of risk of losing jobs and so on, but also they are the one more affected because that's how the large model train themselves on art from the past, on visual art. And that's why it's getting a lot of lawsuit coming from many. And I found that interesting. And the reason, and the specific question is, as artists, we all are, especially, you guys, for example, that write the story, you're definitely affected, just to give an example, by, the Asimov, the Lovecraft, and all you know, this giant sci-fi from the past, and we all eventually get something. We become what we consume. Music can be the same thing. Director can be the same thing. Cinematographer. How do you feel about that?
So there's a big difference here, right? And I actually write about this in the introduction to the anthology. All of us as artists, we learn from people who came before us, whether by reading stories, by looking at artwork and emulating that art. We learn from that, but then we eventually develop our own styles. And those, you know, the artists and the writers who stand out are people who add something unique to the conversation. The machines, the large language models, are incapable of truly learning. They can just mash things up. They can make a mixtape for it, but they can't write a new song in a practical way that matters. So it, in of its own, I don't think that's necessarily a problem in the use cases that I've demonstrated earlier. So, you know, being able to brainstorm, being able to just come up with a, you know, funny cat picture to post on the internet, you know, those are theoretically anodyne, they're harmless. But the problem is that in order to come up with that cat picture, the large language models, those databases, are filled with copyrighted cat pictures created by humans, which it then digitizes, mashes up, and spits out some sort of correlation from that. So the people who created the original data that it's trained on are not in any way compensated. And the argument that they make is, hey, a bunch of tech bros stole our data and are now profiting from it without us seeing anything. Whether or not that actually bears out legally is a question, because you're going to have all sorts. I mean, we're just not ready. Like, you know, we have no case law that covers this whatsoever. And even when we do have some kind of rulings, there's going to be different countries and even different states where those rulings will be different. And so if Japan, for example, which seems to be very friendly to LLMs for the moment, if Japan says it's legal to train on any data set, you know, that doesn't break copyright law, then what is to stop these companies from just opening offices in Japan and continuing mm-hmm. to do what they're doing in Japan, even if United States, for example, says, no, you can't do that, you have to pay the artists. So there's always the genie is out of the bag, you know, it's out of the lamp. You know, there's always going to be that ability to create these, you know, beautiful images that are based on stolen art. The question is, as a society, are we okay with accepting that? And so, for example, people who purchase, you know, science fiction and fantasy and romance books are very strongly against any sort of AI being used as cover art, and they will just absolutely blast the publishers on social media and cancel pre-orders and otherwise react to a book that does that. Of course, that hurts the author, who has no control whatsoever over what is being used for their cover art, unfortunately. But it is a response that continues to get real artists hired and employed. There's also all sorts of other, you know, reactions that we can have to this. Conventions, some of the largest Comic-Con level conventions, in fact, Dragon Con, which is one of the largest and it takes place in Atlanta every summer, they just announced that they will absolutely not allow any printouts of AI art sold at the convention, so that only the real artists selling prints of their own art will be able to profit, but not the people who generated something in 5 seconds and then printed it on a glossy paper from, you know, in a nice printer, but didn't actually create it. Mm-hmm. So I think that those approaches are actually better than the legal approaches and the law, than filing the lawsuits, because as long as a society we refuse to accept stuff that was not created by anyone, stuff that was just generated by an algorithm, then that will create the opening for human creatives to continue to earn a living of some sort. You know, it's not a lot in most cases for people who write and create art, but it'll continue, giving us those opportunities that would otherwise, if ethics were completely taken out of equation, would otherwise just go to technology. Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. And my question, I've done it a few times. I asked that question. It's definitely provocative and wanted to know what you think. I agree with you personally, 100%. And the old debate about giving the copyright of something to the AI itself, you're really probably thinking a little bit too much outside of the box, in my opinion at this time. But the fact is this, and I'm going to come to the last question. Remember, we leave the card, the playing card for leaving for when you come back, because I would love to have you back. Lately, I'm asking this question to redefining society. I always say, you know, we're constantly redefining society. The moment I finish, I think I had to redefine it because of technology. We have to redefine it again. New social contract, new concept of privacy, identity, work, and all of that. What do you think it is the most important thing that we need to redefine at this time in our relationship with art and when it comes to artificial intelligence?
I think we need to understand what is and isn't art. And this is, art has always been subjective, right? Like we, you know, somebody places a banana in a case at a museum and people go, okay, yeah, that's art, but it isn't. It's just somebody who left a banana behind. So art is in the eye of the beholder. And as a society, I think that we need to kind of take steps toward appreciating artisanal art, stuff that's actually created by human beings, versus attempts at art that are being generated by computers, at least until a true artificial intelligence is created, emerges. And then, you know, I would love to see what an artificial mind that can think for itself and is not just regurgitating data has to say. I would love to read that book or look at that painting. But I'm not so excited to look at an artificially generated image that is just an amalgamation of human created artwork.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. So I think we let the audience with a lot to think about, people that are interested in playing around with AI and love reading. And of course, I will dig into this for sure. And I recommend that, as we said at the beginning, links to your website and where they can find this art will be on the notes. But again, there is a lot to think about. It's okay to have different perspective, but I always encourage, give it a go. At least you can make your own perspective. Don't just go with the wave and the flow. Because I do think that sometimes people just decide to say no to something without actually trying it and really figure out if it, what you can, what it is and what is not, which has been at the core of our conversation, what it is and what is not. Alex, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for hosting me. And I appreciate the deep and intelligent conversation and just actually being able to dig into some of these things. The perfect venue for that.
Absolutely. I'd love to have you back. And for everybody else, if you enjoy the conversation, share it, subscribe. If you're watching the video, here we are, saying goodbye. And if you're just listening, share it and subscribe to Audio Signals if you're listening there, and Redefining Society if you're listening there, because I think it is perfect in both containers. So again, goodbye everybody. Thank you, Alex. I hope to have another interesting conversation with you soon.
Thank you.
BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
SquareX helps organizations detect, mitigate, and threat hunt web attacks happening against their users in real time. With its innovative browser-native security product, SquareX safeguards enterprise users from a spectrum of web-based threats, encompassing malicious files, websites, scripts, and compromised networks. Learn more at sqrx.com. At AT&T, we simplify securing your most valuable business assets by providing broad cybersecurity experience and award-winning services. We manage the risk, you reap the reward. Learn more at cybersecurity.att.com.